Edgar Carret, it's a great pleasure to meet you in the flesh. We've been reading you for years, enjoyed you by phone on Open Source. I want you to suppose that 100 years from now, people are reading this very hot, popular writer in Israel in 2008, Edgar Carret, and looking for the truth about Israel. What would they learn?
Well, I think that they learn that the people in Israel know a little bit less than what they pretend to know, that they are a little bit less confident than what they want the, at least the neighbor to think, you know, that there is a very strong ambiguity and confusion among the Israeli people, and the same ambiguity and confusion that all human beings tend to share.
May I read one of your stories to you? It's called Moral Something, and we were all struck by it. And then we can go from there. Here's the story in two pages. The guy on TV said the military court gave the death sentence to the Arab who had killed the girl soldier, and lots of people came on TV to talk about it. And because of that, the news went on till 10:30, and they didn't show moonlighting. It made Dad so angry, he lit his pipe in the house, and it stank. He's not supposed to do that because it stunts my growth. He yelled at Mom that because of her and the other lunatics who voted Likud, the country was becoming just like Iran. And Dad said we were going to pay for it and that it was eroding our moral something. I don't remember the word, whatever that means. And the U.S. wouldn't put up with it either. The next day, they talked to us about it at school. And Sion Shemesh said that if you hang a guy, he pops a boner, like in porn. So Tzila, our homeroom teacher, kicked him out. Then she said different people feel different ways about the death penalty, and no matter what argument you make for it or against it, people would have to decide in their heart. And Sachi, the retard, who was left back two times, started laughing and said the Arabs would have to decide in their heart after it stopped beating. So Tzila kicked him out too, and she said she wouldn't listen to any more nonsense. She was just going to teach us our regular subjects, and she got back at us with a ton of homework. After school, the big kids had a fight about how if you hang somebody and he dies, it's because he chokes or the rope breaks his neck. Then they started betting cartons of chocolate milk and caught a cat, and they hanged it from the basketball hoop, and the cat was screaming. In the end, its neck really did break. But Mickey's a cheap ass, and he wouldn't pay for the chocolate milk. And he said it was because Gabi had jerked on the cat and that he wanted a do-over with a new cat that nobody touched. But everybody knew it was because he was a cheap ass, so he had to pay. Then Nissim and Ziv said that they should beat up Sion Shemesh because he was a liar because the cat didn't get a boner. And Michal, she's the prettiest girl in the school probably, came by and said we were all disgusting and like animals. And I barfed, but not because of her. Why did he barf?
Well, I think, you know, many times it doesn't matter if you're a child or a grown-up, you're very... There's a strong disconnection between the things that you do and the things that you think you feel and the things that you really feel. You know, it's very difficult to bridge that gap. But I think that sometimes we're kind of going through the motions of things that everybody around us do. Mm-hmm. And it seems to be okay because everybody else is doing it. But deep inside us, we feel that it's not really okay.
Hmm. Edgar Carret, can you explain how you became the sort of rage among young Israelis? You're a sort of anti-epic, anti-macho, cuddly, eccentric vegetarian who writes about people who are beset by perplexity and pain and incredible violence and, as you say, confusion.
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, growing up in Israel at the Zionist time, I think that one thing that we were not allowed is to be confused, you know, being surrounded by so many enemies who want to attack us, you know, and it's the last thing that you want to do is to kind of raise more questions or be confused and uncertain. But at some stage you realize that that actually the fact that, you know, that you live in such an unsafe situation makes all those questions that you're supposed to postpone actually more urgent. Because if you're going to die for something, you want to know what you're going to die for. You know, you don't want to postpone it for later.
Are these stories written from the perspective of a writer who's worrying what he's going to die for?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, it doesn't matter if you die for or live for. There is something about life, especially when you come from Israel, which is a region that is so, it's in a region that it's so, everything is so extreme. There is something very overwhelming about life, you know, and you kind of, it kind of leaves you with your mouth open, with your jaw kind of falling down, you know. And I think that this is the sensation that I want to write about, because there is something about Israel that whenever you speak to people, they give you this feeling that they're certain and they have all those answers. And they have all those answers, but you know, but those answers seem to be working all around us. Mm. So I think that if there's anything that I want to say about this reality, is that maybe take some sort of a Socratic position and just say that we may know less about what's right and what we are feeling in a certain moment and what should be done. I'm saying, I feel that it's important to admit our limitations and our confusion just so we can start finding the real answers. And it's much better than kind of doing that and settling for some fake answers that seem to be going on around the circulation for the last 60 years.
There seems to be a spiritual condition of stuckness in these stories, stuck between love and suicide sometimes, stuck upside down in one story, a loveless couple that is attached at the lips, hanging upside down. Should we read these as stories about a country in a war zone where the peace process keeps stopping?
Well, I think that, you know, that the stagnations that you can feel sometimes in the stories, and of course you could always feel it in the peace process because, you know, there's been a peace process for so long, but this process is not getting anywhere. Then I think that this kind of stagnation is something that I would say that it's the enemy of all humanity, this tendency to get kind of to get into this quicksand of life, and instead of like being in an authentic position and making every time a new step and finding yourself on a new terrain, just find yourself, you know, kind of repeating things that once had meaning, but now you don't even know why you keep doing them.
Do you put these stories into some place in Jewish history, Jewish folklore, including Kafka, or should we read them as stories of this detached moment in Israel?
Well, I think that the Israeli stories told from a Jewish perspective, in that sense that, you know, they talk about the Israeli reality, but they use the rhetoric of writers like Bashevis Singer or Shalom Aleichem or Isaac Babel. They use the rhetoric of the outsider to tell those two stories. You know, it's not a story told from, let's say, the heart of the consensus of a nation. It's a story of somebody who's going with all the other soldiers in the regiment, but doesn't really know where or why is he going.
You've spoken of yourself as both insider and outsider, as a Jew in the diaspora of Israel, turning that whole idea upside down. Explain where your head is now.
Well, I think that when I look at Israel, it's both my home, but a place that can seem totally alien to me. You know, there are many decisions taken by the government or by other powers in the country that I completely don't identify with. I think that this kind of strategy of writing this into stories, it's my own kind of roundabout way of trying to affect reality, just by kind of trying to show those things that seems to me arbitrary and strange, just as they are, you know, in this context. I don't really know how to do anything else, you know, to affect reality. I think that, you know, the attempt to affect reality through literature is so pathetic that I think that the only people who kind of dare to do it are people who are desperate enough.
But what does it say then that this sort of dissenting Socratic voice, yours, has become so popular in Israel today?
Well, I think that, you know, when I started writing, I wrote into a vacuum. I wrote into this place where nobody wrote to before. Because usually the Israeli teacher dealt more with the story of the group, you know, of the nation. And telling the stories of those people who completely don't belong, then regardless of the ways that I told those stories, I think that many people kind of identify with those characters. And it was the first time that they could find such a character in Israeli literature so that they can identify with.
The last time we spoke was during the Lebanon War 2 years ago. What's the direction of feeling among people like you in Israel since then?
Well, I think that the one good effect that the Lebanon War did have was the realization of many Israelis that having a strong army will not provide Israel this ultimate safety, because as strong as the army will be, the country will still stay vulnerable in a position of war. And this, I think, made many people who thought that our only goal should be to have a stronger army realize that without a diplomatic solution in the Middle East, we simply never will be able to be safe.
And what do you think is the effect, if any, of this realization?
Well, I hope that it will make people realize that, you know, that we should work more strongly on the negotiation route, you know, with Syria, with other countries, and try to find some sort of solutions that won't be achieved only because we have a stronger army, but will be achieved by the fact that the countries around us will negotiate a peace with that, you know, with us. And I think, again, you know, that's the only way of kind of reaching a stability in the region. And I think that the Second Lebanon War kind of broke the conception that we can stabilize the area just by being strong enough.
Edgar Carey, crowbars and killings and severed heads keep popping out of your pages. Suicide seems to be ever close. In one story, two men are drinking. Uzi is suicidally depressed, and his friend Eitan is suicidally ecstatic. The thought of suicide gives him the happiest feeling he's ever had. How much more violent can the human scene get?
Well, I hope not much more. I have no kind of fascination about violence. It's just that it's the reality. It's the terrain that in which I grew up, you know. I'm saying it's like, I think when an Eskimo poet writes about snow, it's not because he likes it, you know. It's just because that's what he knows.
Should we read these as war stories? I'm thinking specifically of the sense in which Tim O'Brien, who wrote about Vietnam, said that as a first rule of thumb, you can tell a true war story by its absolute and uncompromising allegiance to obscenity and evil. If it's pretty, it's not a war story. Does that apply to you?
Well, I think, you know, it's difficult for me to imagine a pretty war story. But I really think, you know, I usually don't accept this kind of accusing thing on evil. You know, I really think that that most of the horrible thing being done by people are usually motivated either by fear or by some sort of automatic actions. I think that, you know, evil people, there may be such people, but they're so rare. You know, I think that you usually see them in American films playing the bad guys. But in real life, it's just clashing narrative and other slightly more ambiguous things that manufactures that evilness. You know, it doesn't exist as something evil. It's just that some sort of a meeting point between an emotionally sensitive, susceptible person and reality can create things that are evil, but they're not purposely evil, usually.
Do you think of these as war stories?
I don't know. I think that usually my association of war is like, let's say, this almost like symmetric conflict, you know? in most of my stories, you know, my protagonists, they don't fight back. They just usually get beaten really hard. So I don't see them as war stories. I think it's a... If there's something about it, it's a story about people who try to rebel against reality. And many times they pay duty for that, you know. But it's not a war story in that sense that there is never this kind of a class that you don't know how it's going to end. Usually when my characters meet their enemies in the stories, you know who's going to lose. But you know that even those people who are going to lose, they're going to keep their optimism and they're going to keep their belief that life can get better. It doesn't matter how hard you're going to beat them.
Edgar Carret, what is the service of fiction, do you think, in a society so beset with violence, so close to war and the risk of it?
Well, you know, I think that, you know, that the fiction or art in general, you know, they're not as effective as a bullet, you know? I think that, you know, that they can offer some sort of comfort. I think what they do most of the time when they're successful, they give you this kind of AA meeting feeling that the emotions that you feel or the fears that you experience, they're not only yours. It's a collective problem. They can construct this, let's say, abstract support group of people who are in a reality that they don't want to live in and that they want to change.
Reading your stories, I keep wondering, is there a Palestinian version of this mind? What is the effect on the Palestinian imagination of this same eternal war tension?
Well, first of all, you know, I'm the first Israeli writer after the Second Intifada started who was published in Palestine. I was published in Ramallah. So I guess that there is some sort of an affinity in those situations, because if not, I don't think that they would have chosen to translate me. I think that they connect to this feeling. And I co-written a collection of stories which I published with a wonderful Palestinian writer called Samir El-Youssef, called Gaza Blues, that is really consisted of my stories and his novella, telling actually a fable that sounds almost the same from the Israeli side and the Palestinian one, of individuals that find themselves caught in a reality that speak on very big narratives, but it's actually moved and motivated by the smallest and tiniest emotions.
I like the story in this collection called Gaza Blues about a lawyer, Weizmann, who is gagging on his cigarettes, but he's representing Palestinian plaintiffs. And he says at the end he missed his calling. He should have been a black American singer. Billy White and the Dismals, he says. That's what they'd call us. We'd do nothing but the blues.
Yeah, well, you know, this is one of the only stories that I've written that is based on a true story, because I was with this lawyer in Gaza when he took testimonies from Palestinians who suffered from Israeli attacks. And there was this point where, let's say, you know, when he was in Gaza, he was completely with the Palestinians. And when he was in Israel, he was completely Israeli, you know, drinking his espresso and wishing he could have afford a bigger car. But there was this kind of point of transition between moving from the Palestinian territory to the Israeli territory, in which he couldn't kind of contain this gap. He knew it was going to change, you know. He knew that those two separate entities, the ones that sit with the Palestinian and take their complaints, and the ones that sit in Israel and wishes they have a bigger office, that there was this moment of, like, you know, sometimes, I don't know, when you have static on your TV, that he didn't know who he was. And his instinct in real life was really saying, I wish I was born really far away from this place. You know, I wish I was a black blues singer singing in New Orleans. But I felt that he made this choice solely because of the blues, because he felt that, you know, that he had the blues in his soul, and he could just make out of it complaints that he would fire, send to court and nothing would happen with them. but he believed that in another life he could make great songs out of this blues that he had.
Is there something of Edgar Carret speaking there?
I really feel that there is something much more modest in my aspirations when I interact with life. So my fall is, although it exists, it's less destructive than the fall of this lawyer who really went to Gaza hoping that he can make the world a perfect place. I really feel that my aspirations are really so tiny that I think that if there's one person who reads my stories and see reality as a little different, and it's good enough for me, and I feel that I made some change. I don't aim so high, so I think that my fall is not as bad as these guys.
Edgar Carret, what is the human relief that these stories seem to cry out for?
Well, I think that if there's anything that they wish for the ability to contain reality. They really wish for the ability to be there in the moment, see things as they are, and connect to them emotionally, because it's something that is so difficult when the emotions are so extreme. You really have this thing that you kind of short circuit. You cannot take it anymore, and it can make you very dull and indifferent. And I think that there is something about my characters that they are kind of, it's like somebody that you put this incredible jolt of electricity through his body, but he refuses to let go of the wire, you know. He refuses, he's just there, and he feels all this electricity going through him, you know, and he's able to contain it. And I think that this is really my wish, being able to contain it and not really short-circuiting on this hard reality.
Do you mean to say you want to build up the resistance rather than lower the voltage?
No, I'm saying I prefer the voltage not to exist at all, but when it exists, I want to be able to take it. I want to be able to take it. I don't want to let go of the cable and say, you know, I'm staying here on the side. I don't want to feel, or I don't want to think, or I don't want to contain what's going on around me. I'm saying that, you know, if the voltage comes, you know, I really want to be able to let it go through my body and still remain in one piece. You know, that's my wish. You know, maybe I'm asking for too much.
Are you speaking as an artist, as a citizen, as a human being?
As an amateur electrician. No, I'm speaking as a human being, you know. I really don't. I think, you know, artist is a good title to get visas, or I don't know, to impress girls. But basically, when you write, you know, you're a human being who tries to talk about his feeling. You know, an artist is just a compliment. It's like somebody who tells you that you have, I don't know, a nice smell. But you know, I would write even if people would say that it's not art. Hmm.
Where will your characters be in 5 years in the Middle East? Say 2013 or 2020?
The truth is that the most chances that in 5 years from now they will be in a semi-similar position, dreading the future. You know, that's what they do. You know, that's what they're doing now. They will be probably not so far from where they are now, but the fear of the future will be as petrifying as it is now.
We will be reading you all the way. Edgar Carret, it's a great pleasure to meet you and to hear you on Open Source again.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here again.